unemployment rate ticked up slightly to 4.7% in December, and 156,000 non-farm payrolls were added to the U.S. economy.
That gives a total of 2.2 million new jobs for 2016, which is less than the increase of 2.7 million in 2015.
And the story here is that President Obama has a mixed legacy on the job market, but he's handing over an economy right now to President-elect Donald Trump, which is on a steady but still unspectacular path.
I think the Fed is going to raise interest rates more than they expected. We're at near full employment. The Fed is taking its foot off the gas pedal. If the Congress and the President put their foot down on the gas pedal, the Fed is going to have to pull it off more rapidly.
If we look at what the market is currently pricing in, it's pricing in roughly 2 hikes this year. So 3 is slightly more aggressive. So I think there is a risk that the market is slightly behind.
Fiscal policy coming out of Trump land is so muddled. We have to see what he comes out with.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Sheridan, sitting in for Jim Poplava today, who is actually out sick with laryngitis. We're going to be speaking to Jonathan Krinsky. He's the chief market technician at MKM Partners. He has a lot to say about the S&P 500 and the overall U.S. market. We're going to go in depth in terms of the technical parameters or the metrics that he uses to judge the health of the stock market. And we're going to look at trend, momentum, breadth, and sentiment. And of those four, he says sentiment is the only one that is issuing a cautionary yellow flag at the moment, with investors being much more optimistic after the Trump win. So you don't want to miss what he has to say. After that, we're going to have Ned Schmidt, who's going to be today's guest expert on commodities, to discuss both gold and the agricultural commodity complex. So we're going to discuss a lot of the key drivers that are moving both gold and the agricultural commodity space.
And I'm John Loeffler, and normally this is our first active show of the new year, and it's the time when we do predictions for the coming year, but Jim Poplava's out sick this week, so we're going to have to hold off on that until next week. But let's go down to the Wall Street area and see what happened this week. Well, here we are, a new year, and of course that means a new market. With us right now to talk about the week in the financial market is Ryan Poplava, who's CEO of Poplava Financial Services. And Ryan, it's been a couple of weeks, as we usually take the last couple of weeks of the year off to rerun some of the most influential interviews, as well as have a final discussion with Jim to review how the big picture is shaped. Next week, we'll be doing some predictions for the coming year. So can you tell us what the primary concerns or beliefs are you think are influencing the minds of stock market investors and traders?
Well, John, overall, the bottom line for investors is a bit of a combination of just a gradual move, or rather the removal of Fed's accommodation. Good economic numbers. I've been talking about that before the elections and the minor correction we had leading up to those events. And those continue to reinforce growth. And the one thing, you know, even on that note that we got this week were some of the auto sales numbers. And those are elevated. They're high. They're still doing well despite, you know, a jump in interest rates over the past few months. And that's a really great sign, because that was one of the areas that everyone said that, you know, if rates skyrocket, we're going to see housing correct and we're going to see autos correct, anything based on finances and leverage and correct, and that's not happening. So the economic numbers continue to be strong. We see that also overseas. In fact, the ECB was talking about higher CPI numbers over there, and that has led towards a little bit of strength in the euro. Stability in China's currency for now. There were some fears leading up to the first week of the year here, as the Chinese are allowed to move money out of the country. I forget the amount. I think it's around 50,000 yuan, somewhere around there, that they're allowed to do. And there was concern of, you know, flight of capital out of the country and what that would do to the currency, like we saw in January of last year and like we saw in August of 2015. And so far that hasn't showed up. Actually, some economic numbers have helped the currency. And then there's the high expectations laid out for Trump and the Republicans to form a fiscal stimulus plan, whether that's deregulation or maybe some spending in there as well. You know, these are the things that are generally guiding the market, the underlying support for higher prices right now. And there's also concerns, of course, out there, namely just stretched valuations. But back to this week, John, the economic numbers released this week were solid, given where we are in the expansion cycle. And economists are beginning to find comfort in the jobs report not being too hot, not just based on, you know, what that could do to the Federal Open Market Committee and its pressure to raise interest rates, but just given that we're near full employment, they don't expect us to see real hot numbers and to see, you know, just a tremendous reversal in job growth to the downside or upside. It's just going to be what they believe is steady. And that's typically what we see towards the end of a cycle in the business cycle. But you know, the increase in average earnings that was announced in the jobs report this week was noticeable, right around 0.4% for December. And that kind of stoked a bit of the inflation trade. And what that means is, you know, treasuries were weak. So prices fell, yields went up, the dollar went up, so strong dollar, and stocks went up as well. But with an FOMC minutes this week, they weren't that hawkish. And there was some concern that they might be, just given where we've been seeing the economic numbers, some of those inflationary numbers, like the average earnings we got just a couple of days later after the minutes. But with the employment number that wasn't hot, and given the FOMC minutes weren't that hawkish, estimations right now are for the Fed to maybe raise twice this year. And this is really early, John. We're January. I don't know if you recall last year, the FOMC, the dot plot where the different members were anticipating where rates would be at the end of 2016. At the December meeting in 2015, they had expected they would raise around four times. They rose one. So it's anyone's best guess of where things are going to be in February and March and April, May, and June. You know, it's way too early to say. You know, prognostications are a very big thing in this business right here in January, but you know, it's anyone's best guess. But other than that, the concerns right now are stretched valuations, any kind of currency hiccup stemming from, gosh, some of these inflationary issues, how that relates to FOMC monetary policy and what that can do to currencies. China, as I said, like we saw in August of 15, January 16. So far on that front, like I said, China's numbers have been healthy, supporting their currency, but it's still very low relative to the dollar, and that stimulates trade for them and exports, etc. And Trump has stated in recent speeches that trade with China, that's in his crosshairs. So discussion over trade with China either kind of simmers or it flames red hot, you know, based on some of the things that Trump has been saying. But that's what's going on, John. You know, it's relatively stable, a lot of quiet news. You know, we're not in the earnings season yet. A lot of companies have been quiet. There's a couple M&A activity, but nothing really, really moving the market. No real major catalyst. It's just kind of steady as she goes.
Yeah, and it seems like everyone's waiting until after the inauguration to see where things are going anyway. So it really does seem like much hasn't changed over the past few weeks. Investors are still buying into the Trump rally. They seem not to worry too much about his tweeting policies. What do you think of Mr. Trump's two economic tweets this week? There was one on GM, and then there was another on Toyota.
Yeah, I think if you're a short-term day trader, that's the kind of thing you might be watching right now. That might be at the top of your Twitter feed or whatever. Who you're following is Trump, because he is moving markets. It's funny because, you know, if Roosevelt was our president today, would it be called Fireside Tweets? Possibly. Trump has found Twitter to be his best line of communication. And that brings him directly to the public. No filters, nothing like that, hindering what he's trying to say and his message. So what is it, 144 characters or something like that?
Yeah.
He's making ample use of it. And definitely he did that last month, doing it again this week. Yeah, you're right. You know, specifically, he targeted GM. If I can recall what he said, something about sending Mexican-made model of GM's Chevy Cruze to U.S. car dealers tax-free. And he's doing that across the border. He said, make it in U.S. or pay big with a border tax. And it's funny, GM opened up down on Tuesday because of his tweet. But guess who canceled their plans for a plant in Mexico just following that? Ford. So it's making waves. And on Thursday, gosh, yeah, Trump stated Toyota plans a plant in Baja, which I think is actually false. I think the plant is already there. I think he meant further down in Mexico, in more central area. They're planning a Corolla plant. But he said, yeah, you build a plant and pay big in border tax. I guess that's his thing. You know, pay big, huge, I guess, border tax. Trump's tweets, they're interesting. Just a catalyst for day trading, I guess, in the short term. And as I've said, it will be an interesting year in fiscal policy. And Trump's made that very colorfully clear, I guess I'd say. And his tweets are right at ground zero of what's on his mind. But yeah, manufacturing and U.S. jobs in the U.S., that's his target. That's what he's hitting. And who knows? This could really lead to, you're talking about deregulation, and he's talking about more, U.S. focused trade. This is definitely going to be a fiscally minded year.
Yeah. And what I call the great reneging begins, because candidates say a lot during their campaigns, right, and then there's the reality of what they can actually get done after they get into office. And that's clear across the board, a whole panoply of issues that President-elect Trump has been talking about for quite some time. So you're right. The interesting part is the social media part, however, because Franklin Delano Roosevelt was one of the first to make direct access. When he did the fireside chats that you mentioned, he was able to talk to people directly, and the whole country was out there listening. So he was able to make his message go across in an unfiltered manner. And once again, you're seeing this whole new change of a whole new crop of independent media that have sprung up here and in Europe and elsewhere that are end running what used to be traditionally the gatekeepers of news and information. And it's changing the whole face of everything. So, well, okay, it was a quiet week, it seems, on the market. We came really close. We were just talking about that.
Really close
on Friday to Dow 20,000. I said, okay, it's on sale, $19.99. So,
$19,999.
Yeah. And 99 100ths. So what kind of catalyst do you anticipate in the week ahead that could move the needle on that target? What do you think?
There's a bunch of speaking events next week. Obama on the 10th. I seriously doubt it's going to move the market. Trump's going to follow that up, though. And he's been moving the market. Deregulation and fiscal stimulus, there's a lot of expectation that that's going to help GDP. So yeah, he's been moving the market, not just on individual stocks like GM. Yellen speaks as well on Thursday. That's not an FOMC decision speech, but I believe some sort of economic conference. And the FOMC decision date will be on the 27th. And then finally, earnings. We're going to look at individual companies, look at the status of how things. Remember last quarter, John, when we talked about results in the third quarter, were much better than they had been. And there was actually growth in earnings overall. And that kind of, it was an inflection point for the earnings recession that we had been in for so long. And that, to me, that was a big story. And it was kind of clouded a little bit by events around that time with the election and Hillary versus Trump. But it'll be interesting to see. It'll be, I think, an important time to look at how things are going, maybe reflect on valuations as we get these updates. But yeah, the Friday the 13th will be a big day for financials next week. And I thought this was interesting, John. I was just looking into Friday the 13th. There was a book written by Thomas Lawson called Friday the 13th. It's funny. It's a story about a broker who takes advantage of the superstition to create a Wall Street panic on that day. And it just goes to show you that kind of gloom and doom still sold back then. That was actually 1907 and can still sell now in our industry with newsletters, etc. But interesting, Friday the 13th coming up next week will be big financial day.
And I bet you didn't know that there was a book about a ship just like the Titanic, which came out just a few years before the actual disaster happened. And the scenario was almost identical. So it's interesting how sometimes fiction mimics or predicts what's going on in reality. Okay. Happy New Year, and look forward to, it's going to be another interesting year, which of course is what makes news gathering and reporting on financial topics interesting. But I appreciate it, Ryan. Have a good weekend.
No problem at all, John. We'll talk to you next week after those speeches. Yellen and Trump, those are the ones to watch.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Large numbers of factories across the U.S., once vibrant with human activity, now lie dormant as America's manufacturing boom of the last century, as the 20th century, have given way to the forces of globalization and automation. As we know, Trump has made a promise to make America great again. One way to do that is to return a lot of the manufacturing jobs to America. However, if we look at some of the large industrial buildings that were built during the 20th century in a lot of the major manufacturing hubs around the U.S., a lot of them have fallen apart, but some of them are being increasingly restored. And they're part of this transformation that we're seeing, even being referred to as factories of the 21st century. Joining us on the show today is Graham Pickren at Roosevelt University. And Graham, let's talk about some of these buildings and how they reflect a deeper transformation, I should say, of our economy to one based not so much on people, manufacturing workers, as we saw in the past, or even really large industrial machines, but one that's now based largely on information.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that we're all well aware of is sort of the ascendancy of digital technologies and their role in social life and the economy. And as Trump, you know, as a good exhibit of in our politics, too. And I think, you know, one of the things that's worth keeping in mind is that a digital economy and digital technologies all still require physical infrastructure. And that's one of the sort of drivers of this reuse of industrial space that we're seeing across the U.S. and other parts of the world, where we're seeing former manufacturing sites close down retail locations, offices, both in cities and in some cases in rural areas where the infrastructure of the building itself, as well as its connectivity with other places, often originally created by the railroads, now is being used to serve the purposes of processing digital information. So turning things like factories that used to bake bread here in Chicago into data centers, which are essentially large buildings that house servers, which are basically computers, that store, process, and manage all of our digital information. And by digital information, we're talking about things like streaming Netflix. You don't actually have the movie you're watching on your TV or computer. It's stored elsewhere. Well, it's stored in a data center. So data centers need a lot of the things that factories also need. They need lots of electric power capacity to run the servers. They need lots of cooling capacity to keep those servers from overheating. And they need connections with other data centers and with users. And that's where things like fiber optic cables come in.
Joining us on the show today is Jonathan Krinsky. He is Chief Market Technician at MKM Partners. And unfortunately, Jim came down with a pretty bad cold, so I'm going to be taking over the interview for today. Jonathan, tell us, we're speaking actually on Thursday, I should note, and the Dow has been hovering below that 20,000 mark for quite some time. It hasn't yet been able to break out above. We'll have to see if that happens on Friday. But it appears that this is serving as a fairly important psychological threshold. Do you take any credence in the idea that round numbers like that of 20,000 have some importance for investors and can serve as some type of ceiling that we need to get through?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. It's certainly possible, and it does appear to be the logical number that everyone's watching. And as you mentioned, it's been maybe a few weeks now since we got very close to it and have not been able to push through. But from our perspective, really all that's happened since it first attempted to push through has been a pretty orderly consolidation. And after the run that we had off the November post-election lows, it's not the worst thing to kind of move sideways and work off some pretty extreme overbought conditions. If you go back to when we first really made the highs in the Dow and first approached 20,000. We had some of the most extreme overbought readings we've seen in 25 years. So again, not surprising to see a consolidation. And, you know, the fact that it's just under 20,000 does add significance to that level. And then ultimately, if we should break through, which we think we will, that 20,000 resistance would then become a pretty important support, I think, on the downside.
Okay, so as you just said, you think we are going to end up breaking through that 20,000 level on the Dow. You know, if we go back, just kind of taking a retrospective here of what took place in 2016, we had that big sell-off in the beginning of the year, and then markets finally bottomed around the February timeframe. And then we saw that major move up, a consolidation for about a month or two before we saw the Brexit. And then there was that minor sell-off that took place with the Brexit vote, and then markets just turned around and screamed higher in the second leg. It's almost like the second step up, and then consolidated again until we saw the election of Trump, in which case we saw another major move. So it's kind of this three-step move with two consolidations in the middle. Is that kind of where you see us now? As we've seen this big move after Trump was elected, and now we're just in a consolidation phase, and you think eventually that's going to resolve to the upside?
Yeah, I mean, traditionally, after a big up move to see a sideways consolidation, it then resumes in the direction of the primary trend, which in this case for a while now has been to the upside. What's interesting about Brexit and the election is those were actually the shakeouts, the downside shakeouts that created the fuel to get us to new highs. And that's been more of the theme of late. So, you know, while we still remain constructive, it certainly is possible. And maybe we need one of those mini shakeouts to get fear back in a little bit. And then that kind of provides the fuel the shorts have to cover. And that provides the fuel to actually finally get us to break out. So, you know, we're not sure which way it's going to happen, if it's just going to break out on its own, or if you need a bit of a downside move first. But either way, we're still pretty constructive on the primary trend here.
Okay, so that's interesting. You said that the Brexit and November elections both served as some shakeouts to really eliminate all the sellers, and then buyers stepped in and just pushed the markets higher. That goes back to sentiment. And I want to note, so there's four different things that you outline in your recent technical strategy report in terms of what a technician, and I should note you are the chief market technician once again at MKM Partners. So as a technician, there's these four things that you look at to determine the health of the bull market. Would you mind going through each of those for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So the four checks that we primarily focus on, and then there's obviously many sub areas within those, but the four main areas are first and foremost trend, second momentum, third is breadth, and then fourth is sentiment. So if we kind of run through them briefly, first being trend, one of the things we like to do is take out the price and just look at some long-term moving averages of the S&P, namely the 10-month and the 20-month moving average. And these are very long-term. They don't tend to flip-flop very often. But if you go back to January, February of last year, we actually had the 10-month cross below the 20-month moving average for the first time in a while. In fact, the last two times we saw that negative crossover was entering the 2001 to 2002 bear market, and then again in 2007, 2008. So those signals, while they don't come around very often, were to be respected. And you know, we did see a pretty sizable move down into February. Even though we didn't get a 20% drawdown on the S&P 500, we did see about a 19% drawdown on the equal weight S&P 500, 26% drawdown on the small caps. And then if you go back sector by sector, there was a lot of bear markets on the sector level and certainly on the stock level. So even though it didn't fit the true definition of a bear market, there was enough carnage below the surface to kind of qualify in our work. And then more recently, we actually saw the 10-month flip back above the 20-month, and both are now firmly rising. And our view is generally that the slope of any given moving average is more important than whether price is above or below it. So we now have a rising 10-month, a rising 20-month. They're aligned properly. So that gives us our primary definition of an uptrend, and we're going to stick with that for the time being.
So as you said, if we look at the 10-month and the 20-month moving average, those are pretty good indicators of the overall trend. And you have a chart here. I'm going to link out to how you show the 10-month and 20-month moving averages and how they behave over time in terms of whether or not we're in a longer-term bull market or a bear market and the shifts that occur between those, because I think that's a very important chart for understanding just the technical trend. And as you said, we got really close in 2015
2015, the 10-month moving average started to really decelerate and move below the 20-month. And like you said, that showed that we were at risk of moving into a bear market, something that we saw in May of 2008, in March of 2001, and even briefly in 1994. And I want to note, when we had you on our show in the past, and we've had you on for some time now, during this time, I believe you were making our listeners aware of the fact that, hey, we are seeing some deterioration. But if I remember correctly, your own outlook was aligning more along the lines that this is a pause and a consolidation and not really the beginning of a major peak in the market. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, I mean, coming into last year, we were pretty bearish, pretty cautious, you know, but I think when you look at the secular picture of the market, there was never any type of secular top, which we saw in 2001 and 2008, which would indicate more of the 40 to 50% magnitude decline. It was always more of a cyclical bear, which tends to be more in the 15 to 20, even 25% drawdown. And again, even though we didn't see it on the S&P 500, we certainly did see it across some secondary indices and certainly on the sector level. So, and then just back to your point about the 1994 period, there are some similar analogies between that period and what we're seeing now in that that was one of only four times, 1994 into early 95, where we went more than a year without making a new 52-week high in the S&P 500, but it wasn't within the confines of a 20% drawdown. So again, we saw that as of June of last year, we had gone more than a year without a 52-week high, but yet we didn't see a 20% drawdown. And that's really indicative of that kind of what we'd call a stealth bear market, because if you think about what has to happen to go a year without a 52-week high, there has to be a lot of internal deterioration in stocks, but because there's a constant rotation among stocks and among sectors, that's really what prevents the full bear market 20% drawdown. So again, in 1994, heading into 95, we had that long period of consolidation. Similarly, the 10-month actually did cross below the 20-month moving average on the S&P. And then, of course, we know in early 1995, the market broke out and never really looked back. So I don't think we're in any type of move like we saw in the late 90s, but I think it is important to recognize that we did see a long period this time without making much progress, and now it does look like we're resuming that primary uptrend.
Okay, well, let's move back to the four other things that the bull market checks, as you refer to them. So we did discuss trend already with the 10-month and the 20-month moving average. That is now in a bullish posture, the 10-month above the 20-month, showing that the trend is positive once again. So what about the other three? You discussed momentum, breadth, and sentiment. Let's go into each of those.
Yeah, so momentum, there's two different types of momentum. There's market external momentum, talking about the indices, and then there's internal momentum, talking about single stocks. And I would say the internal momentum perhaps isn't that great. And that if there were strong internal momentum, that would mean that there's strong trends. Those trends are, there's stocks that are trending and outperforming, breakouts are working. So that's been a bit of a struggle last year. And even though it's the early part of this year, it still also seems to be a bit of a struggle to get continued momentum internally. But if we're talking about the index level, one of the things we look at is a monthly MACD indicator. And again, similarly to the 10-month and 20-month moving average, it takes a long time for this indicator to change and does tend to have very reliable forward returns. So similarly, in late 2015, we got a negative or a MACD sell signal on the monthly indicator, and that proved to be pretty timely and accurate. And then in September of 2016, we actually reversed that and got a monthly MACD buy signal. And that was actually the first monthly MACD buy signal in about 4 years, since 2012. And if you look historically, when you get the first monthly buy signal in over a year, there tends to be very strong forward returns. So that was in September. We've obviously seen some pretty good returns already since then. But, you know, as long as that remains on a buy signal, I think that should be the focus there from a momentum perspective. And then if we're moving on to breadth, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think is probably the most important is just to look at the number of stocks trading above a 200-day moving average. Obviously, we know the S&P is firmly above its 200-day, but you want to kind of keep an eye on the rest of the market. So if you look at the Russell 3000, which is pretty broad based, that's about 98% of investable U.S. equities, we have somewhere around 70-73% of all stocks above their 200-day moving average. So that's pretty healthy. If you compare that to where we were in July and August of 2015, prior to that first initial breakdown, if you remember in the summer of 2015, that reading was around 60, even a little bit lower than 60%. So while it may seem like a small difference, it does tend to be a pretty good level. So as long as you're kind of above that 65% threshold, that's indicating that you're in a pretty good spot as far as breadth is concerned.
Okay, so as you know, breadth remains strong. More than 70% of the Russell 3000 is above the 200-day moving average. That's considerably stronger than we were in the 2015 period when we saw the last market peak. So that is also on the positive side. So trend is positive. The momentum, when you look at the monthly MACD, that's on a buy signal, so that is positive. Breadth, again, is positive. So I guess the last thing is sentiment. What are you seeing there? Are there any warning signs that investors have now moved from perhaps the disbelief phase in the bull market cycle to acceptance of euphoria? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so sentiment is certainly the one of the four that is a bit of a, I would say more of a yellow flag. And so we know that sentiment has become much more optimistic. If you're looking at the surveys, the investors intelligence has recently seen the percentage of bulls around and actually at that 60% threshold, which is what they themselves describe as the danger zone. The American Association of Individual Investors is also at a pretty elevated level. And then there's some other areas to look at, such as some transactional indicators being put call ratios and different things like that. So those have all moved from, if we go back to Brexit and then obviously into the election, we've seen some massive swings from the fear that was prevalent ahead of those events. And then now we're really on the other side of that. But what makes sentiment difficult to use as a timing tool, particularly at trying to call market tops, is that sentiment often remains very optimistic for extended periods of time before meaningful drawdowns. It tends to be more timely at market bottoms. And for some examples, if you go back to 2004, there were many, many weeks, if not months on end, between 2004 and 2006 where the investor intelligence bull reading was around that high 50s, even 60% area. And that went on for 2 years. So really, I think the main takeaway here is that, yeah, sentiment is no longer a tailwind. It's clearly caught up with the fact that the market is at all-time highs. But again, market being at all-time highs, you'd expect people to be optimistic. And I think the best way to think about it is bullish sentiment is only a bad thing when the market internals begin to deteriorate and sentiment remains optimistic. So, you know, if we were to see some of those first three checks begin to roll over and you still saw sentiment remaining very elevated, that would be a much bigger concern for us. But right now it's just no longer a tailwind, but, you know, it's hard to use it as a sell signal at this point.
Yeah, as far as sentiment goes, one of the things that I'll check in on every once in a while is the CNN Money Fear and Greed Index. And that's because it's just easily accessible by anyone. You can Google that and it'll bring up, and it has the gauge reading from red extreme fear to greed, extreme greed. And I did note, I think it was several weeks ago after we saw that major push higher in the markets, that we were getting pretty high in terms of extreme greed levels on their index. I think we were at about 90. 100 being the highest. And it certainly told me that we were due for some type of pause or consolidation. And we have seen that since. The CNN Greed and Fear Index has pulled back some, but it's still in the greed zone. Let's talk about some of the sectors that you're watching. Are there any important signs or real big breakouts or deterioration that you're seeing in various sectors you think that our listeners should be aware of in terms of indicating where the market could be heading, or what sectors are revealing about the economy as a whole?
Well, there's two that we focused on a couple weeks ago. One was financials, which, if we're talking about from a sentiment perspective, clearly the sentiment on financials has swung immensely. They were just so hated for so long. And I think clearly now they're more accepted as a long idea. But what's interesting about financials, they're actually the only sector over the last 10 years that has a negative return. So despite the fact that they've rallied a lot recently, I think if you take a step back, if you look at just the chart of the financials themselves or on a relative basis versus the market, you can make the case that there is still more room to run. Now, on a short-term basis, this is where some of the shorter-term sentiment indicators and positioning may suggest that maybe we need a little bit more time to consolidate or to flush out. But I think looking ahead, despite the fact of the recent sentiment, you can make the case that financials still have some decent upside. On the other side, a sector we highlight is consumer discretionary, and we know even actually today it's interesting that we're seeing massive drawdowns in some of the traditional retail stores, but discretionary has been rather weak on an equal weight basis for the last 3 to 6 months. And if you look back, though, since the 2009 lows, discretionary is still the best performing sector. So it's almost the opposite in that financials have done very well recently, but over the last 10 years, they haven't done much versus discretionary, which has done very poorly recently, but over the last at least 7 or 8 years, has actually done very well. So I think that's an area where you could continue to see reversion to the mean where financials outperform discretionary. And certainly today, at least on the discretionary side, that's the case. And then the other sector that is obviously getting a lot of interest in the new year is healthcare. It was the worst performing sector last year, the only sector to finish negative. So, you know, there is some reason why the investors are beginning to look at that again and want to make the case that it could be a rotation candidate. And we're open to that idea, but we haven't seen quite enough evidence that the trend on a relative basis has turned such that, yes, it's seen a decent bounce to start the year, but we don't have the confidence that it's going to be an outperformer for the rest of the year at this point. It's certainly a good start, but we just need to see a bit more evidence, I think, in a couple of days.
Okay, so you discussed financials. They have seen a strong move in the wake of Trump's win, moving just almost vertically if you look at the financials ETF, XLF. And then you also talked about healthcare. They were one of the worst performing sectors for 2016 and consolidated from their strong move that we saw probably from 2009. So there is some room there, you think? And then another sector that you focused on was semis. What's the important message when you're looking at the semiconductor sector?
Yeah, so semis are actually an industry group within tech, but they were the best performing industry group of the 24 basic industry groups last year. But what's interesting is they closed the year right at a pretty interesting Fibonacci retracement level. If you go back to the all-time highs in the SOX index from 2000 and then all the way down to the 2009 bear market lows, if you're to go back 61.8% of that, that's right where the SOX index closed the year. So I think that's kind of interesting. And given the fact that it was the best performing group and it had such a strong run, I think it was up somewhere in the 25 to 30% area on the year, it would make sense to see some consolidation or pause there. It doesn't mean that the semis have to go down a lot, but I think there's probably other areas of the market that could see more upside as the semis kind of consolidate some of their gains.
So, Jonathan, just to recap, according to the checklist that you gave, you know, really the four different areas that we can look at from a technical standpoint, trend, momentum, breadth, and sentiment. Sentiment is the only one that currently has a yellow flag because you said investors are really becoming much more optimistic. We can see that if we look across various sentiment indicators. But once again, sentiment is not a great timing tool. As you noted, it would be concerning if sentiment remained optimistic and if the market internals really deteriorated. So that's one of the things that we'd want to keep in mind. But overall, it sounds like, you know, given those four different major categories that you outlined, that certainly gives a more bullish outlook for the market. It doesn't sound like you are yet warning that we're at a major peak in the markets. Would you say that's a general summary of where you stand?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate, Chris. And, you know, it's important to remember that even if we are at some sort of major top, which we don't think we are, but, you know, they take time. And if we go back to the last intermediate top in 2015, I think the market essentially peaked out in late 2014. And it wasn't until August of 2015 when we actually got some real price breakdown on the index. And so typically you'll see stocks breaking down on the stock level and then the sector level before the indices finally crack. So there's usually a bit of a warning or leading indicator before you have to be too concerned. And again, we just go back to the fact that the primary trend, the moving averages are all rising, and that warrants sticking with that trend until it reverses.
Well, Jonathan, I want to thank you for coming on to Financial Sense News Hour and speaking with our audience. If any of our listeners wanted to get their hands on your work or speak to you more, what would be the best way to do so?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Chris. The best way would be to check out our website, www.mkmpartners.com. And I would also encourage listeners to follow me on Twitter at jkrinskymkm.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Joining us on the show today is Andrew Zatlin at Moneyball Economics. He's also a top-rated forecaster as ranked by Bloomberg in terms of many economic metrics. And Andrew, I want to talk about the piece that you just wrote, which was your 2017 first half prediction. And the message there was stability but minimal growth. Tell us what it is you're looking at.
So I think we have to do sort of a 2020 hindsight. You know, where were we and how that informs where we're going? We were standing here last year, and there was a complete meltdown in the global economies. And a lot of that was we had too much supply. There was a supply overhang, an inventory overhang, and companies were caught out by that and all of a sudden had to scramble. And a lot of that scrambling meant hitting the brakes hard on hiring, a lot of layoffs as well. And we're talking the industrial side of the economy here. As we get through that, as we enter into 2017, what we've been seeing over the past few months has been that realignment has occurred. And what that means is they've got, for the current level of revenues, companies have the right level of investment, the right level of staffing. And so as we enter 2017, that's the question, is what comes next? And this is a very coin-operated type of thought process, where they were very defensive in the middle of last year and the first part of last year, in the sense of, you know, what's happening to us, all of a sudden getting blindsided by a crash in demand, crash in prices. As they've come through that storm, companies still don't have a lot of strong visibility as to what's going to be the tailwinds driving things forward next year. So there's still a little bit of a defensive posture when it comes to investing in people and things. But the background is the sentiment is positive in the sense that there's no bad news. And so if your glass is half full guy, which I try to be, that's a good thing. Stability is a good thing. It means no surprises. It means that they can plan. They can raise prices where possible. They can plan better. Stability, if your glass is half empty guy, means that's great and all, but there's no movement forward. And let's go back to the definition of economic growth. If there's no movement forward, after a while, a company starts looking for further efficiencies. If you've got no growth or just moderate, mild kind of growth, you know, 1 or 2% at the top line, you're still not going to be investing in people and things. And so, again, that's kind of that eye of the hurricane experience. If your glass is half empty guy, you're basically saying that's great for right now, but after a quarter or two, if we still don't see that traction, that rise in economic activity, companies have to make decisions about their headcount and so on and so forth. So that's sort of the setup. That's the background as we come into 2017. And so companies right now are looking at basically two things. The background is there's still too much supply. If you look at things like factory capacity utilization, it's at almost a two-year low, meaning there's just so much factory capacity that could be turned on overnight if the demand is there. So companies aren't going to invest in expanding factories. There's not going to be a lot of machinery buying. There's not a lot of people. You look at Ford and GM. Last month they said, geez, you know what? We have too much inventory. We're going to shutter a few of our production plants. And that's kind of where we are, is, again, there's not a lot of growth. I don't need to produce more. I don't need a lot of factory expansion. I don't need a lot of people. I'm good where I am. So what's going to get me going forward or possibly retrenching? Companies are looking at the consumer. Right now it's all about the consumer, and there's a dialogue going on. Consumers are also employees. And so what happens is, are consumers spending? If they are, if this was a great season, holiday season of spending, and if they're going out and still spending on things, 70% of our economy is a consumer economy. So if consumers are still spending, then businesses are going to say, okay, that's great. I'm starting to see some relief in my top line growth. I'm going to see some growth. And so I'm not going to hold back on raises. I might even hire some more people. So it has that knock-on effect of creating more excitement now for employees, more willingness to spend. That's where we are right now, is that dialogue where companies are looking at consumers, hoping consumers are spending. Consumers are looking as now wearing the hat of employees and looking to their employers and saying, geez, our time's still good. Within that framework of what's going on with spending, I've noticed a couple things with some data points. We've got a little bit of noisy signals. You know, we have the car companies coming out with a fantastic December. We can shoot holes at that a little bit. Geez, yeah, you know, it was great, relatively speaking, but they had to spend a lot more on incentives to get people in the door. You have Ford and GM saying we have too much inventory. Well, that's not good. That means that, you know, to be honest, actual car selling wasn't as good as they'd hoped. But we have positives there. We still have positives. People are out there spending. They're buying cars. They're buying more cars than they did last year. Then you got the Macy's of the world coming out and saying, life is really hard for us. Consumers weren't spending.
Ned Schmidt is joining us today. He's the publisher of both the Value View Gold Report and the Agri-Food Value View. Ned, let's start off talking about the gold complex. We saw a really big move at the start of 2016 in gold and in the gold equity space, quite a sell-off. We're not quite back to the lows, and it looks like gold is trying to find a bid from the lows that we saw that took place over the last couple months. What are your thoughts, and what are some of the main drivers that you're watching when it comes to both the price of gold metals in general and also the gold equity space?
Well, let's start by going back a year to where we were in December 2015. Gold came down through into and bottomed on December 17th at 1046. That was a major sell-off. In other words, when you own something that's weak in price and it goes into year-end, people book their losses. And they do that finally in December. They finish. So we got a bottom at 1046 in December 17th of 2015. We then rallied to 1376, at which point gold was overdone. There was too much enthusiasm. And then this nonsensical dollar rally took off on the idea that the whole world's going to move all their money into dollar deposits because they're going to get 25 basis points more in interest. And that set us into a bottom on December 15th, which was the day of the interest rate announcement. There was no more good news going to come out, or bad news, however you want to think about it. So gold bottomed at 1123. And it has since rallied up to 1185 on an intraday basis. So in a big picture, we got a major low in December 2015. We tested that low in 2016, and now we're bouncing up far. So short term, it's probably oversold. I mean, overbought. What's unfolding that's interesting is if you go back to December 13th, which was the day before the FOMC meeting, gold is up 2% from that level as of the close yesterday. We're talking on Friday, and I'm using Thursday's closes. The gold stocks are up 9%. Silver's a laggard because it was so strong last year. But the important point is the gold stocks are up 9%. Gold is up 2%. The S&P is off. The S&P is flat with December 13th. The Dow is flat with December 13th. Now, the NASDAQ 100, which was a real dog last year, is up today 1.5%, something like that. So gold went through the worst it could go through, which was the psychology in the second half of 2016. Now as we go forward, what's going to happen to the dollar? Well, it's already starting to unravel. Most recently, it's interesting, the three strongest currencies recently are the Russian ruble, which broke 60 yesterday, the dollar, and the South African rand. So two of the three strongest currencies are ones you would not expect. So I think the market's telling us that metals and oil are probably going to do all right for the next year, because that's what Russia produces, and that's what South Africa produces. So the dollar is causing some real problems globally. And if the dollar doesn't come down, we're going to see in the second half of this year some major debt defaults by foreign banks and foreign borrowers. So that's a positive background for gold as we go through the year. The other thing that's happening is people have forgotten that interest rates do matter to stocks. We've had two rate increases already. We're going to get at least three this year. There is no way the NASDAQ 100 is going to return a positive value in 2017. You're going to see the NASDAQ 100 and all of wonderful techie and internet stocks get hammered by the end of the year if interest rates go up another 1.5%. Right now, the vulnerability of the NASDAQ 100 to a rate increase is about 18%, and that's going to cause a shift in interest to gold. People are already losing money in bonds. The 10-year treasury hit a 2-year high, and it's working on a 3-year high. And so the only asset left is gold and agriculture, which we'll talk about later. So I think you got to look at this big picture that we had the bear market low in December 15th, 2015. We tested that low and stayed well above it in December 2016. And the backdrop is good for gold because if you look around, everybody expects inflation to pick up, and it has picked up. I mean, the labor report this morning, I think wages were up 2.9% from a year ago. So the environment globally is going to be good for gold because gold is still the underowned asset in Western portfolios. And so I don't think people should be looking for it to happen today. I think it's going to unfold a lot more gradually over this year. Now, for those that like technical analysis, what we had was from 1046 in 2015 to the 1376. That was a wave one. We've just completed a wave two, and we should be in a wave three. So the future looks fairly optimistic.
You know, Ned, it's interesting because going back to what you said in terms of this gold bottom perhaps taking some time and your bullish outlook not coming to fruition all at once. One thing that I read that I thought was pretty interesting, and there was a note from some other analysts on their technical outlook for gold, and that was as it relates to this upcoming debt ceiling debate, whatever form it's going to take this year. And I think that's supposed to start around March. And then they were saying, you know, that might end up unfolding for the next 2 to 3 months after that. So they were relating the positive outlook for gold to what we're going to see with this debt ceiling, because we're now at, you know, 19 trillion. We're going to be approaching 20 trillion on the U.S. debt. And then when that subject comes up, that's going to be dominating the news flow quite heavily. So the thinking was, is that, you know, wait just to see what gold does when we approach that time frame. Do you have any thoughts on how the debt ceiling debate factors into your outlook for gold?
I think it's going to be a lot louder this year because while Trump has said he doesn't mind using debt when it's cheap, he's also said that he doesn't like the size of our total debt. So I think it's going to be very vocal. The other thing that happens in March is we're probably going to get a rate increase. But there are two vacancies on the Federal Reserve Board right now. And so Trump is going to nominate two additions, two new people to the Federal Reserve Board. And he's already said that they will not be economists. He has been very vocal about that. He doesn't like that we've had a Federal Reserve stacked with PhDs in economics. So one of the nominees is going to be the former chairman of BB&T, and he will take the vice chairman slot, which is a regulatory slot. And their view is, in the Trump camp, is banks should lend money to businesses. Banks should not be lending money to speculate in the stock market. So we're going to see a shift in the Federal Reserve away from favoring the stock market to favoring the real economy. And that is probably going to cause the inflation numbers to trend up. And so that is favorable to gold. And it's a negative for the U.S. stock market. I'd be very surprised if we have an up year this year in U.S. stocks.
Well, we did see a pretty good year last year with after the Brexit and then after, of course, the Trump win, you know, double digit move in a number of the major indices. So 2016 was a good year for stocks. It was even a better year actually for gold, for GDXJ, for GDX, both of the gold mining indices. If you track those, you know, those were up very strongly. So now a question is, it comes down to, I think you alluded to the fact that we're going to see the Fed hiking rates this year, maybe within another month or two. I think some of the expectation is that that's going to be taking place around the March FOMC meeting. And there's this whole adage that goes back many years with three hikes and a stumble. So from what I take it, you're thinking that that's probably going to repeat itself again this year?
It already did last year because the NASDAQ, and I say the NASDAQ 100 because those type of stocks are the most vulnerable to interest rates. A stock with a fat dividend is not as vulnerable. That's the mathematics of it. And the NASDAQ 100 really didn't do very well last year. You know, the Dow was up 13, NASDAQ 100 was up about 6. So it's already having an effect on those stocks. And you get one more hike and then a second one, and those big cap growth stocks are the most vulnerable. And so you got to be very careful managing your exposure to them during this coming year.
Ned, it's interesting. I think, you know, some of the big risks that our listeners should probably be aware of for this year in the near term is, like you said, we are going to see another rate hike. And there is this whole adage of 3 rate hikes and a stumble in the stock market. So that's one thing to be aware of. The fact that you said that Trump is going to be making some appointments to the Federal Reserve Board. So that's going to be shaking things up as well. And then, you know, one other thing that isn't getting a lot of attention, but something that Trump has said in the past regarding debt is renegotiating some of our debt agreements. And that would be to lower the amount of debt that we owe to some of our trading partners, you know, whether that be China or other large owners. To me, that seems like that would be a pretty big event if that were to happen. That would be injecting a massive amount of uncertainty into the global financial system. Do you have any thoughts on that point?
Trump is a negotiator. He likes to sit down at the table and put out a variety of ideas, half of them which the person he's negotiating with can't stand them. You know, they're really painful. The other guy does not want to do these 4 ideas. The other 3 he might not like, but these 4 he hates. And so he puts out a variety of proposals on the table. And what he does is what Henry Kissinger always said to do. You've got these 4 that the other guy really hates. You slowly discard them till you get to 3 ideas that are all right. It's better to accept these 3 ideas than those 4. And I think this is one of his 4 negotiating ideas that are ultimately going to be discarded. So I don't put a lot of worry into that. Just always remember, Trump is a negotiator. So he's going to put a lot of things on the table, and there's going to be some of them the other person really hates. And this is one of them the other person really hates. So it'll end up being a trading point.
Yeah, from a negotiating standpoint, that's an excellent tactic, right? Because you put forth enough proposals, some of which your opponent or whoever you're negotiating with knows they definitely do not want to ever touch or even agree on. But if you hold that out there, they feel like they win if you agree on something that was more of a neutral. So maybe that is more of a negotiating tactic on Trump's part.
And that was the way Henry Kissinger always viewed it, which is interesting.
Yeah, a little bit of game theory on Trump's part. I don't know if he does that consciously or unconsciously, but as you say, he is quite a negotiator and has a lot of experience in that area. Ned, let's talk about the agricultural commodity complex, because, you know, once again, you are the publisher of Agri-Food Value View, so you follow this area quite closely. What are some of the developments that you're watching in the agricultural commodities that you think our listeners should be aware of?
Well, let's set the stage a little bit by what's been going on with the agricultural equities. Maybe this will draw people's attention to them. Last year, 2016, the ag equities returned 17%, and there's not a single major indice that came close to that. I mean, it did twice what the NASDAQ 100 did. What happened is, first, the stocks bottomed in the end of February, and they've risen to over 20%. From that low. The agri-food prices bottomed in the first week in October, last week in September, and they're up over 20% from that level on average. My index is. Now, the stocks said bottomed in February, prices bottomed in the September, first week of October. That's about 7 months. That's the way the stock market seems to work. It discounts 6 to 8 months ahead of time. Now, prices for the whole sector, I follow 18 commodities, have been exceptionally strong. All but one of those, 17 of them, are off their 52-week lows. Only one of them is a low, and that's malt barley, because people aren't drinking enough beer. Those 18 commodities from their lows, 52-week lows, are up roughly 30% from their lows on average. Now, averages hide a lot of things because big numbers and little numbers will distort it. Half of them, 9 out of the 18, are up over 20%. So the pricing has turned around starting in October and have advanced very strongly. And there's a number of them, like palm oil, which most people in the United States don't recognize, but it is the biggest vegetable oil in the world, basically sold in Asia, China, India, and the countries around them. So we've got a pricing environment that is exceptionally strong all of a sudden. The question gets to be, why is that? If you listen to the trade analysts, They'll talk about how big the harvest was, how big the inventories are, and ignore the other important side of the question, which is demand. Demand in the past year has been exceptionally strong. In the United States, we supply about 25 to 30% of the world's grains. Our exports of grains, the five major ones, soybeans, corn, wheat, rice, and sorghum, are up 25% from last year. Corn exports are up 40% from a year ago. Soy complex is up 26% from a year ago. And the baffling one is wheat. It's up 33%. Now, last year, they took the last bullish analyst on wheat. They took her out in the street and shot her. That was the last known bullish wheat analyst. But if you look at the wheat situation, prices and shipments are telling us demand is exceptionally strong. Now, what's interesting about this, Chris, is where the demand's coming from. And it's not coming from where people think it is. And if we look at the regions of the world, like North America, South America, Africa, Europe, and we look at corn imports, the fastest growing market for corn imports is sub-Saharan Africa. Their imports through this year will be up over 200%. Southeast Asia, their imports will be up over 60% versus 2013. North America comes in there. Four is North Africa. Well, basically what we're seeing is incredible demand coming out of developing nations. And one of the arguments had always been that as China and India grow, these other nations are going to grow with them and demand will expand. And surprisingly, what I keep finding, Chris, is Africa is becoming an exceptionally strong market for agricultural imports because it's hard to believe, but the sub-Saharan Africa has one of the best economic growth rates around. You probably look at India now, China, and then sub-Saharan Africa for solid, good economic growth. And so we're seeing a lot of demand from developing nations. And if we look out a little bit, the kicker coming in, I've been waiting for this kicker for over 5 years, Chris, is India. India now is the number six economy in the world. They displaced England recently. The economy is going to grow at 7.6%. We're looking at sometime in the next decade, India going from importing 6 million tons of food to them importing 80 million tons of food. We're going to have a real problem feeding India, and I don't know where we'll get the food for Africa. So the demand is just incredible there. And the problem is when you look around at the stock market's at a level that's ridiculous, there's some interesting concepts out there, but you do have to look internationally, because that's where the growth is.
Well, Ned, as I noted in the beginning, you are the publisher of both the Value View Gold Report and the Agri-Food Value View, where you discuss in depth agricultural commodity complex, gold. You provide a lot of really great technical analysis and also your outlook for both of those areas. So if any of our listeners want to find out more on each of those publications, could you tell them the best way to do so?
You can find my work on my two websites. The first one is the valuevewgoldreport.com, and the other one is agrifoodvalueview.com.
Well, it was sort of an abbreviated show this week, Chris Sheridan, but next week, Jim will be back, and we'll be doing our predictions for 2017. Anything that you're looking towards on your weekday show on Financial Sense Insider?
Yeah, next week we're going to be talking with Axel Merck, and we're going to discuss what's going on with the dollar, gold, a lot of different currencies. There's a number of developments that he has on his radar that he wants to tell our listeners about, so you don't want to miss that interview with Axel Merck. Other than that, we're probably going to be touching upon what we see with Tesla and lithium. A lot of big moves there, also in uranium too, so expect to hear an interview about that. If not next week, in the week after. So those are some of the areas that we're going to be touching upon as we look forward.
All right. So on behalf of Chris Sheridan and Jim Poplava, until next week, I'm John Lufter. Have yourself a very safe and sane weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.